Accession number 27755, Reel 1.
Leslie Wright, Reel 1.
Yeah. My name's Leslie Wright. I was born and bred at number 29 Wyndham Road, Bournemouth. My father was working for Lipton's at the time as a van driver. He broke his wrist starting the car one time and had to be off work for about a fortnight. And when he went back, he was told that somebody else had taken his job. And he was out of work for quite a considerable time. And as we had a family of nine, my mother and father had to struggle quite considerably to raise us children. We did lose three of our children early. There were twin boys born, the last of their family. They died in a matter of months. But my eldest sister, who would have been my eldest sister now, she died at the age of 2 1/2 with meningitis. So it was a big loss for us. And that particular year, we also lost our grandparents with whom we were living in Wyndham Road. My education was at St. Clement's School, and it was an elementary school education. And I also attended St. Clement's Church as a choir boy and as a server there. We were poor. We were very poor. There was no doubt about that. But we lived quite a good life. My mother and father went without themselves in order to see that we were well fed and everything. And I grew up with my brothers, and sisters came later, actually. My sisters were quite a lot younger than my two sisters, who are still alive now. They're considerably younger than me. But the boys, my eldest brother was about 5 or 6 years older than I was. But my second eldest brother was only a year and a half difference, and my youngest brother was, again, less my age, about the same amount. He lives at Tongue Road, down Pool Lane at the moment. Because of our financial position, we younger members of the family had to make do with hand-me-downs all the time. And at school, St. Clement's School, where I went to, I was constantly ribbed by this, and you know, it wasn't a very pleasant situation at all there. But nevertheless, I got through the schooling in quite a reasonable manner, and used to play for the football team there and all that sort of thing. As far as amusements were concerned, we in those days we had to make our own amusements. So I had a small wheel that we got from the scrap merchants off of a pram or a pushchair, and we used to stick a piece of wood in the hub and then steer it about with a stick, and we got very adept at moving it all over the place. Also, we used to get orange boxes from the greengrocers and make ourselves up trolleys, four-wheel trolleys. Again, the wheels came from the scrap merchant, you know, and we made the front to steer so that you could sit in the box with a rope and steer it down the road. This is the sort of things that we had for amusement, and I can assure you, I think we enjoyed them more and appreciated them more than any of the toys that the children have today, because they're presented with them. They don't have to work for them. You know, they don't have to make the things. I think it's good for character building, personally. You know.
Use your imagination.
Yes. Oh yes, this is what we did, and that's how we did that. Then, where did we get to? I started work at the age of 14. I was an errand boy in a greengrocer's and fruit and flowers shop, and I was on probation for the first 2 months at 2 shillings a week. That's 2 old shillings, 12 1/2 pence nowadays, you know, something like that. 26 pence, that's right. And then I went to 2 shillings and 6 pence, which was 12 1/2 pence a week. And of that, I gave my mother 2 shillings for help with housekeeping, and I had sixpence for my pocket money. Now this week consisted of 6 days, 8 till 6, and just a half day on Wednesday. Wednesday afternoon was a half day. But after a year, I found a better job with Wilkins, the bakers, a local bakers, and my wage went up to 17 shillings and sixpence a week. And I worked there for about 2.5 years, and then my father, who finally got himself a job in the Bournemouth ice cream factory, he got a job for me there. So I joined the Bournemouth ice cream factory, and my wage went up to 30 shillings a week then. And I worked there in the production room making ice cream in Palmerston Road up until the time that I enlisted in the RAF, which was toward the end of 1939, just after my 18th birthday. And then, of course, I went through the war. 7 years, I think, I was in there through the war. I wanted to be a pilot, actually, but they wouldn't accept me because, as I told you, I only had an elementary school education, and they claimed that I needed to know trigonometry, which I didn't. But actually, they were short of gunners at the time. They were all short of gunners. So I opted to become a wireless operator air gunner. And I went through the war, all through the war, and without a great deal of injury at all. It was a fairly mild sort of war for me, actually.
Did you think there was going to be a war?
Oh, no. We had no idea until the signs started looming around about 1938, toward the end of 38. There were these ominous rumbles from Europe, you know.
We had Chamberlain going across.
Yes, and then Chamberlain thought he'd secured a safety for us, but of course he'd been duped by by Hitler and his clique. So the war did take place, and we were totally unprepared for it in England here. We hardly had any fighting forces at all, but that was neither here nor there. We managed to fool the enemy into thinking that we were all powerful. Our naval force was the best force at that time because it was a gigantic naval force. It really was renowned throughout the world, you know.
How did your parents did they talk about? Feel there was going to be a war?
Is
there much talk about it?
Well, it seemed all so unreal. And when it actually started, when the thing actually started, I was not in the service. And I used to get up on the roof at home because we had a couple of attics with skylight windows. And I used to climb out of that and get right up on the top behind the chimney and watch the dogfights over the channel here. And
what was that like?
Oh, it was that was something to me because flying was my love. I built aero models from the age of 13, I think it was. I started building model aircraft, and I always read books about the First World War aces. You know, that was why I wanted to be a pilot. It sounded really glamorous to me. You know, in those days, and. So that was how it all started out.
Can you recall when war was declared?
What was that?
Can you recall when war was declared?
Yes, it was
declared war.
Yes, it was declared. Actually, it was declared. I can't remember the date now, but that's right. And I was in the 23rd Bournemouth Rover Sea Scout crew at that time, and we were down. I was down in Christchurch Harbour. I'd been out sailing with one of the other members of the crew who I worked with at Bournemouth Ice Cream Factory, and we'd stopped off on the spit on the Hengistbury side by the Black House there, which was a restaurant, and we were just sitting outside on the sand, you know, supping tea when we heard the announcement on the radio in the cafe there.
And how did it make you feel when you heard that?
Well, I was elated because I knew that I was going to be able to get into the RAF then and do what I wanted to do, you know. And It was a little time after that before I got in, but anyway, to start with, I think it was November. It was over the Christmas period anyway, and I went up to Cardington for my attestation. That was just beside the two large R101 hangars, the airship hangars, you know. And we went up there for attestation, and we were turfed out, I think, three times that night because of air raids. And these shelters had no lights, no heat, nothing in them. And it was bitterly cold and that. And by the time the end of the night had gone, I thought, I wish I was back home with my mum and dad. Anyway, I caught a whopping cold that night from it. But anyway, we moved on from there to Morecambe, where I did my square bashing.
Tell me about that. What was involved in that?
That's marching, learning how to march and all that sort of thing. It's a discipline-inducing exercise, really. It teaches you to learn to obey orders and do as you're told sort of business, you know. But I enjoyed that, actually. I enjoyed the marching. I was so good at it, the instructor kept pulling me out to demonstrate how it should be done to all the others, which didn't go down too well with them, so I got a bit of stick from them when we got back to the village, you know. But anyway, we got through that, and then, because there were so many people training as air crew, all the centres were chock-a-block full, so we had to go off on general duties. We'd do a bit of training and off on the general duties. And from Morecambe, I was sent down to St. Errol, where we were put onto gunpost duties, guarding the aerodrome itself, you know. Again, that was through the winter time. It was quite cold. I know there was quite a lot of snow and that. And it was here that I had my first contact with the enemy, you know. We had this drone was... it had base there, a Beaufort squadron, which nightly bombed the U-boat pens, you know, and the enemy were constantly trying to find it so that they could clobber the Beauforts, you know, and they couldn't find. We had a satellite. They constantly burnt the satellite out with all its dummy planes in it, and boasted that they destroyed us, you know, but it wasn't that. It was the satellite they kept hitting. But this one night they found us, and my first inkling of it, I was on what was known as the church post, because it was near the village church, St. Evel's village church. Anyway, the first thing I was on there. We used to go on with the regulars, and four of us went on duty. So we did 2 hours on. We only did 2 hours on through the night with one of the regulars. So this particular night, the first thing I knew about it was suddenly the whole place. We were down in the dugout, actually. I wasn't on my shift at that time. We were in the dugout, and all of a sudden the place was lit up, in, you know, absolutely incandescent with incendiaries all down the runways in there. Then it was all hell let loose for, I don't think it lasted more than about 10 or 15 minutes, but it seemed ages and ages. And we were told, we had two guns on the gun post, and one of the guns jammed, and the regular bloke brought it down into the dugout to take it to pieces and get it going again. And we were told to dive under the beds, you know, to get out of the way of them, so that they had the room to work. And whilst we were under there, I actually heard the sound as bombs, a stick of bombs dropped all along the row of the Beauforts, you know. But I don't know whether they hadn't fused them properly or whether they were just duds. But They didn't go off, fortunately. Then finally the fire picket got out. No, they didn't. The fire picket didn't get out. The incendiaries finally faded out, and we went into complete darkness again, and we had orders not to fire unless we were fired on, not so as not to give our position away, you know. And just shortly after that, my shift came on, and my turn came on, and I went up and manned one of the guns on the post. And it had been quite an overcast at the time, but it gradually cleared and the moon came out, and then we heard this plane coming in from the west, and I looked up and I saw it was a Savoy Marchetti twin-engined Italian bomber. And as it got overhead, there was the telltale flash from underside, which you can see when the bomb's released, it arcs a bit, you know. And my regular colleague said, "Down the dugout quick," and we hopped down the steps and crouched down outside the entrance to the dugout there. And a minute went by, 2 minutes went by, 3 minutes went by, nothing. I said, "We must have been mistaken, I'll go up and have a look." He said, "I shouldn't if I were you." So I went up, and as I looked over the edge of the parapet there, there was a massive explosion about 200 yards away. It was a landmine, and they come down on a chute, you see, that's why it was so long. And it lifted all the rubble off and hit me just here and caught the underside of my tin helmet and threw me bodily right down the steps of the dugout again.
Did it hit you just on the brow, on your brow?
There was no damage there, but I was winded completely because I landed on the concrete base, flat on the back, you know. It actually threw me, my chin strap, you know, the blast underneath the helmet rim, it lifted me bodily and threw me down the steps. Oh, that was that, but that was the end of that business. But the next day, I was put on sentry duties. Two 500-pound bombs had dropped either side of the watchtower. The one this side had gone down the steps of those half semicircular huts that were about 20 foot long and landed on the steps, and it concertinaed it down to about 6-8 foot with all the fire picket crew in it. And the same on the other side. I don't know who it was in there, but they had the same treatment on the other side. And I had to stand on guard and watch the sappers tidying up and bringing out legs and bits and pieces on the stretchers, you know. And I thought to myself, what the bloody hell am I doing here? Am I Christ? Well, why did I ever want to volunteer for this, you know? But it all passed over, you know, and...
When was the reason? Do you recall when it was? What month or...?
It was after Christmas, I think. Probably January, maybe February, something like that, you know. The snow was still, the snow was still about, yeah. It was, yes, that would have been 1940, yeah.
Were many people killed?
All of the fire picket and the other people, that was, I would think, I know the fire picket must be a dozen and a half, and two of them were members of our course. There were two of the aircrew under training chaps, so we lost two there, plus a lad from the, a young lad, local lad, who worked in the NAFI, had popped in there because the raid occurred as he was attempting to go home, you know. He went as well. And I expect there would be about the same amount in the other dugout, you know. 2-3 dozen people, I should think, would have lost their lives there.
And had the German raid been successful in that it destroyed some of the
planes? It had not, no. None of the bombs went off, so none of the Beauforts were damaged at all. Not a single bomb went off for that lot. So that was quite a do, you know. Anyway, eventually we got posted off onto the first part of our wireless training school, and that was back up to Blackpool. And there we were billeted in private residence there, and we used to march all along the front to the tower, where the tower ballroom was, where our classrooms were, you know. And we went up to 12 words a minute there. From there...
Can you explain for me how the wireless operation training, what you did in the training?
Well, you have to learn the Morse code, you know. And we were told to, when we were walking along and conversing with one another, to do it in Morse. So I expect everybody up there thought we would start raving mad because we were wandering down the road going did it did da did it did da da did it, you know. And that was how it worked anyway. It certainly got Morse code glued into you, and I can still transmit at the same speed as I could do now. I can't receive quite as fast, but I can still transmit it, you know. And this is what we did, and that's how we got up to 12 words a minute.
What else were you being taught in the wirelesses? Can you remember?
Yeah, nothing more. Just learning the Morse code up there. It was down at Yatesbury, the next step. Yatesbury, number 2 wireless training school, that we started to learn about the radio itself as well. The 1082 and the 1083. We had, that's the transmitter and the receiver, you know. And we had to learn elementary repair work on them and how they work, so that if anything went wrong, we could hopefully put them right, you know, to keep in contact and that. Plus, we went up to 20. We went up to 18 words a minute then. That's right, 18 words a minute on that one. And we had a most peculiar end to that particular phase. We'd done all this course and finished it, and then our instructor said, "Right," he said, "I'm going to take you and show you something now." And he marched us over to a hut in the middle of the camp. He said, "Now you can't go inside because this thing's top secret still." He said, "I want you to hook up and look through the windows." And we looked through the windows, and on the bench there was a transmitter and receiver, and it was all, it had 3 ranges, and they were coloured, red, yellow and blue, and the transmitter large knobs were red, yellow, blue, and all the ranges on the receiver were red, yellow, blue. He said, "I want you to forget all you've learnt about the 1082, 1083, because that's the set you'll be using from now on." So we got no training on that one whatsoever, you know. Anyway, then we went. Where did we go from there?
Can you recall the name of anybody in your course or your instructor at the time?
I can't remember the instructor, nor the names of the chaps in the course now. You're talking 5 years ago, aren't you? I can't remember any of them now, to tell you the truth. I can remember the name of the CO there, Squadron Leader Gill. He was a small chap, bespeckled, because I had to go up before him. I got on a charge there. I was coming out of the nappy one evening, and I was heatedly discussing something with one of the chaps I'd trained with about a part of the course, and we were banging away. And as we were going down the path, the orderly sergeant and flight sergeant came up, and as they went by, the orderly sergeant said, "Get your hands out of your pocket, airman," because I was in my pocket, you know. We just went on down, and suddenly there was a damn great roar, "Get their hands out of your pocket, airman," and I said, "Balls," and he heard it, unfortunately. So I went before Squadron Leader Gill, this chap, sort of schoolmastery looking type he was. And I could hardly restrain myself from laughing when he said, "You, 1194-828, AC2 right, whilst on active service, are charged with saying balls to the orderly flight sergeant." I got 2 weeks jankers for that. But that's the only time I got charged for anything serious, anyway.
What did you do in those 2 weeks? What was your punishment?
This was in the middle of June, by the way. And it was hot, I can tell you. I had to report with my full rig on, including greatcoat buttoned up to the top, with all my packs on. I had to report to the guard duty, the guard room, every day, and then go off and do GD duties in the various sections there, you know, where the wets were working. They directed us what they wanted done, cleaning up or whatever. fortnight of that. That's almost what I had. Then from there, we went off onto GDs again. And I got, we went off to Colin.
What were GDs?
General duties, sorry. General duty there. This was Colin, up above Bath there. Just above Bath on the hill. And I got onto teleprinter operating in the operations block. That was quite interesting because I was able to watch all the movements in the ops block, you know, the raids and everything, you know, all that sort of thing. Then after that, there was one other thing there. One day we were taken down for grenade training. We had to learn how to throw a hand grenade. And this flight sergeant took us into this little sandbag bay. And he said, that post down there, which was about 20 yards away, he said, I want you to see how close you can throw it to that, you know. And he took the pin out and put the grenade in your hand, right, whichever you're right or left hand. He put the grenade in your hand and you were holding the lever down still so that it came, when you release it, it came off, you know. They all did this, and there were all sorts of things, you know, and then it got to me. I was a W, so I was usually the last. Everything was done alphabetically, you know, even pay parades. I was the last one on the pay parade waiting for my money, you know. Anyway, he handed me this grenade, and I swear to this day that he gave it to me the wrong way up, because when I released it, I felt it wrap the back of my thumb, and it really nearly wrenched it off. But as a result, my throw just went over the sandbags just in front of us. He shouted, down, everybody! We all had a duck, you know. Boom! That was that. That was my hand grenade training.
It was a live grenade.
Yeah, they used to call me Bomber Right after that. Yeah, anyway. Right, we finished there eventually, and we went back to Yatesbury to do our airborne training and get up to 24 words a minute. And from there, we went to Pembrey for our gunnery school. There, I did well at gunnery, although I was never more than a mediocre radio operator. I just managed to get through all the tests and that, you know, to qualify. But gunners, some obscure reason, guns and turrets, I seem to have been born with them. I had top marks with everything at gunnery school. And I passed out top of the course.
How did you train to be a gunner? Can you tell me what training was involved?
Yeah, well, we used to go up in the Blenheim, and we had to fire. We usually went up with an instructor and three trainee gunners. And you again, I was the last one always, but they had coloured bullets so that they could tell how many strikes you had on the drogue, which was being towed by the target towing plane, you know. And you had to fire at these drogues in all sorts of positions and all that sort of thing, you know. And they used to mark you off as to what you had there. I used to get top marks all the time. In fact, we did what was called a quarter crossover, where the plane started on the port on the port beam, and it dropped down underneath you and came up the other side, and it kept doing that. And you had to hit. You had to get this. They reckoned the only possible percentage you could get with that particular exercise was 2%. And when we went in, after we'd finished this, the next day my instructor called me in. He said, I'm sorry, right? He said, I know it's correct. He said, but you got far above the percentage that is considered to be possible, he said. He said, sir, but I can only give you the top percentage, otherwise the old man will say we flew the drogue too close to you, you know. Anyway, that was the sort of shooting I could do, you know.
The drogue from the other plane, which I presume was the Blenheim as well.
Yeah, that's right. The Blenheim goes under, and the drogue's astern of you, you know, behind the towing plane, obviously. and you fire away at it on the quarter, and you've got to follow it, you know. And that was it.
That was the mid-upper turret on the Blenheim.
Yeah, the turret was a mid-upper one, yeah, that's right. Now, at the end of that exercise, we did an exercise that was, I think it was in, I don't know whether it was in the Blenheim or in the Lysander now, but anyway, it was a cine shot, you know. And in this particular instance, because they wanted to assess your operating ability for the turret, and a turret operation ability, you had to aim straight at the target so that it was in the picture on the whole time, you know. So we did this exercise, and the next day we went into the hut, and our instructor said, right, I'm going to show you these films that you've done now. And he went through about a dozen, picking them to pieces. They were absolutely rubbish and all this business, you know. And he said, right, he said, I'm going to show you one now that that is how it should be done. And, of course, we sat back and thought, oh, yeah, bloody instructor under ideal conditions, probably, you know. And he showed this film, and there was this target in the film over 80